Okay, this entire hour now, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Marcelo Gleiser, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. And we'll take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Marcelo, you're going to have fun with this now because you're going to get questions from all walks of life, all over the place. And so this will be good for you. Fascinating. Okay. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, and our first caller, we're going to go to Hawaii. Before we do that, I want to mention our condolences on behalf of everyone at Coast to Coast for the family of 18-year-old Cheryl Wolf, Miss Hawaii teen, who tragically just died of a stroke. Very sad story there. Let's go to Feli in Hawaii. Go ahead, Feli. Thank you for the call.
How are you guys doing?
Okay.
I didn't know that story. I didn't hear that story. Really sad story.
It sure is.
My wife says hello, Dagmar. We called you before, but my question is, how do you know? I've heard programs where they're talking about you're going back in distance in time, and you're seeing galaxies that were born long time ago. But if what your guess is saying that everything started from every point, why can't we have one of those galaxies right next door? They don't have to go back 14 billion light years back to see something like that. Because I even saw another program that said that when they looked back there with the Hubble, they saw galaxies that looked like they were completely constructed. So how do they know when they're going back? You know, you understand my point?
Well, it's measured, of course, by the speed of light. But Marcelo, let's talk a little bit more about time, if we can.
Right. So it's a good question because it has to do with the fact that when you look at the night sky, you're actually looking backwards in time. Now, why is that? Well, it turns out that the fastest thing that moves about in the universe is light, right? So when you're looking at a star, the light from that star had to travel from the surface of the star to your eye. And even though light is really fast, 186,000 miles per second, I always like to say, what does that mean? Well, if you blink your eye, light goes 7.5 times around the Earth. That's how fast it goes. So the light that comes out from that star, it's traveling towards you, and that takes some time. So, for example, if the sun would blow up right now, we would only know 8 minutes from now because that's how long it takes for light to travel from the sun to us. Not that it would make any difference. It would be the last 8 minutes of your life. But still, the point is that as you look out into space and you look at farther away objects, you're actually looking into the past, right? Now, the point that you made, so there are two different questions. You know, there are stars that are around us, like they're part of our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. They are not moving away from us. They're here and they're just far. And so you can have, for example, the center of our galaxy is about 30,000 light years away from us. So that means that when you're looking at the center of the Milky Way, you are seeing things as they were 30,000 years ago there. Right. Some stars you may look up in the sky and you see a star now. Well, that star may not even be there anymore. It may have blown up since that light left it. So looking into space is essentially the ultimate time machine. Now, the question that you asked about how come things can be next door? Well, because we have to look at the perspective of the universe, which is where we are. And from where we are, we have our own, if you want, Big Bang, in the sense that if you're looking outwards into space, you're going to be looking at things that are moving away from our point, which is where the solar system is, if you want. And this is our point of Big Bang. So if you play the movie backwards, things are going to be coming towards us, right? And we're going to say, we are the center of the universe. We're going to see these things coming to us. But if you lived in another galaxy, you know, you're going to be seeing things going towards you, if you want. One way to think about this is the following. Imagine the surface of a balloon, like a party balloon, and you paint black dots on it, and you blow the balloon. So each black dot is like a galaxy, right? And as you blow the balloon, you're going to see that all the dots are going to be moving away from you. That's the expansion of the universe. But from your perspective of one dot, the dots are going, the other dots, you know, the other galaxies are going to be moving away from you. That's what it means.
Okay. So are you? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's what it means by the stretchness of space, and so that's why different points in the universe are going to be seeing things moving away from them, just like we do see things moving away from us.
Are you familiar at all with physicist Ronald Mallett?
Sure. I know him personally.
Good guy. He's trying. He would love to build a time machine to go back to see his father. He never really was able to develop a relationship with his father. And he's got an interesting theory, but do you think we will physically ever able to travel in time, either forward, and I don't mean for nanoseconds, if forward or backward, like the old movie, The Time Machine?
Well, there is a big difference between going forward or backwards, and I would say forward, yes. It's very much possible. There's nothing in the laws of physics that forbid us from moving into the future. All you need to do is to build a spaceship that travels close to the speed of light. And, you know, we are far from it right now, but it's a technological obstruction. It's not like a law of nature obstruction. We could do it if you travel very fast, close to the speed of light for some time. When you come back to Earth, much more time would have passed on Earth than in your spaceship.
That's okay? A good point.
And so that means that you'll be able to be visiting the future in a sense. So you age 1 year, but people here may have aged 50 years. So you travel 49 years into the future. So, so all we need is basically a spaceship or something that could travel close to the speed of light, which, who knows, in the future that's possible. Now, going to the past is a different ballgame, right? And that violates a bunch of different laws of physics. And so I don't know if Ron is going to be able to do it, because as far as we know right now, there is no way you can possibly build a machine or any kind of process that goes backwards in time. It creates not only technological, it's physically impossible according to the laws of physics, but it also creates all sorts of weird paradoxes. For example, if you go backwards in time, and the day that your grandfather and your grandmother are supposed to meet in the prom and the family starts, you actually go and say, give some poison or give something for your grandfather to fall asleep in the party so they don't dance, they don't meet. What happens, right? I mean, so can you change history? What's the story here? I'm giving you the mild version of the paradox. Okay, there are some more violent ones, but the point is that to the back into the past is a very difficult thing to do with what we know nowadays.
Sounds a little like the movie Back to the Future, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Let's just go get the flux capacitor and put it in the car, and back we go. Yeah,
exactly. We need the flux capacitor. Exactly.
Well, we're in the computer age, so we go to Skype line in Indiana. Matthew, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Matthew. Matthew, are you there? Well, we are in the computer age, but he's not there. But our first-time caller in Salt Lake City in Utah, Mitch, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Mitch.
All right, thanks. I love your show. Listen to it every night.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, my question was, your guest said before that there's not much evidence of intelligent life. And in consideration in concerning UFOs, I was just wondering if he was familiar with the Disclosure Project.
No, I don't know about it. Is that the Air Force project that they're?
No, the Disclosure is a project undertaken by individuals who are trying to bring in government whistleblowers and experts to try to testify to the existence of UFOs and visitation, and the government withholding back, and the push, Marcelo, is to get the government to admit, hey, this is what's been going on. I don't think Disclosure is ever going to occur. You know, regardless of what's going on, I don't think governments will tell us the truth when it comes to that.
And do we need the government? I mean, can't we just see those sightings without the government?
Yeah, possibly, and maybe one day we'll find out without the government. Then they'll have to admit what they probably don't want to. Let's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Nicholas, you're on with us on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is my first time calling, and George, it's a pleasure to speak with you and Marcelo. I'm reading your description of your book, and it seems really insightful, actually. And I just want to ask you about, are you still there?
I'm here, yep. Yeah.
Okay. With going forward into time, right, like every point in space and time is expanding. So whenever you go forward, you're actually sort of, you know, traveling in the future. But what about, is it possible to go into the past with a absolute zero? The thing is, I think that nobody takes into consideration is the fact that absolute zero is the point where all molecular motion stops, but our planet is also moving, so we can't achieve that on Earth. And I heard some really weird stories about them trying to put things at absolute zero, and the particles start trying to leap out of their container. Does that seem at all possible to you?
Okay, so let me just explain to everybody. So absolute zero, he's referring to temperature, and it's essentially the notion that, you know, we live here at our 68 degree Fahrenheit, but it's possible to cool things to a tremendous amount, and absolute zero would be the lowest possible temperature that you can reach, that basically below that you just don't have any heat to take out of the thing anymore, and so you reach this absolute zero. And what absolute zero says, there is a part of physics that studies heat, which is called thermodynamics, okay? And the third law of thermodynamics says that absolute zero cannot be reached, okay? It's essentially violates some very basic notions of physics. In fact, it's related to quantum mechanics that I was talking about before in the show, which is the physics that studies the very small, the atoms. And one of the very important properties of quantum mechanics is something called the principle of uncertainty, okay? And it's not like we don't know anything, we're always uncertain. That's not what the principle of uncertainty means. It just means that you cannot know the position and the velocity of a particle at the same time. So if you think of a little electron as a little ball that is vibrating in space with some energy, quantum mechanics says this little ball can never stand still, because if it did, you would know that its velocity is zero and you know its position exactly, okay? Now, vibration and motion has to do with temperature. And so zero, absolute zero, would be taking all the vibration out of that particle. And according to quantum mechanics, that's impossible. So absolute zero cannot be reached. Only temperature is really close to absolute zero, and those can be reached. And I don't know exactly how that would help us travel back in time.
Okay, good. Thanks for that, Nicholas. Next up, we go to Los Angeles. John, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. Sure. You know, Marcelo, what you were talking about earlier kind of rang true with me, with humans taking back our planet and us being here a short time. Right now, there's a conference for the Weather Modification Association, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the chemtrails or geoengineering, cloud seeding, and what we can do to stop it as a human race. And also, if you're not familiar with it, on Facebook, Stop the Spraying group has a wealth of information. Thank you.
I think that's very, very valuable. I think that anything that we can do together right now to slow down global warming at a planetary scale is extremely important. But we have to be extremely careful too, because, you know, there was this famous American naturalist called John Muir, and he used to say that if you tug at one thing in the universe, you'll find out that it's hitched to everything else, which means that things that we do will have effects elsewhere. So cloud seeding or any sort of changing the reflectivity of the surface of the Earth to reflect more sunlight and hence decrease global warming, all these things in principle are good, but before they're implemented, they have to be tested extremely carefully. And so you have to be very, very, very worried about how these things are going to be done. But absolutely, I think that our mission right now is to fix things that we have essentially screwed up in the last 150 years of industrialization.
All right, let's go back to our Skype line again. Matthew in Indiana. Let's give you another try, Matthew.
Okay, great.
There you are.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, George. How much,
hello? Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if your title was an allusion to the Tarleton slogan, A Cry in the Wilderness, Tear versus Care. And second part of the question is whether you're using Bayesian algorithms on your data to derive interpretations on prediction.
So hold on. So the first one, yes, I used the word tear in the title as a game of, you know, because of tear as well, that if you finish the book and when I come up with this whole ecology idea and how important we are, we can transform a tear into a tear. So I'm hoping that does not happen, but I'm really glad that you catch that one. The second part of the question, I'm not sure I understood. Can you repeat that again?
Well, there's a British mathematician, also a Presbyterian minister named Bayes, B-A-Y-E-S, who's got an algorithm that's being used a lot nowadays for predictive interpretations. Wondering if you're running that on any of the data that you get from the physicists that are measuring things.
Are you talking about Bayesian statistics?
Yes.
I don't do it, but colleagues of mine do it, and they use it when you have many variables and you have to constrain some of them to make some sense of your data. And so they use this kind of statistics. I in my particular research, I don't need to do it, but I'm familiar with it, yes.
Very good. Thanks, Matthew. Let's take one more call before the break, and then we'll come back with final phone calls. We'll go to Doug in Davenport, Iowa, east of the Rockies. Douglas, take it away.
Hi, George. And Marcel, the question I've got is about how your ideas kind of mesh with David Bohm's conception of the implicate order. And what I mean by that is the implicate order is the idea that essentially there's a sort of a underlying reality sort of underneath everything that we see, that the world we, you know, the normal world we live in is sort of an expression of that underlying order. And the ideas you have about asymmetry, you know, because when with the implicate order, the world we see isn't, we're not seeing the world as it is. We're seeing a specific viewpoint of that underlying reality. And so, with, for example, with the difference between with quantum mechanics and relativity, you know, quantum mechanics is one particular way of, it's one particular description of that underlying reality. It's based on a certain context. You know, relativity's, you know, a different one. So the two are essentially different descriptions. It's kind of like looking at a car from two different angles. You can look at it from the front, you can look at it from the side, and you see two completely different things.
All right, well, see if you can give us the short answer, Marcelo, before the break. Go ahead.
So David Bohm thought that this whole randomness and fluctuations that appear in quantum mechanics may be the result of some more complicated reality behind everything. Is what Einstein used to say, God doesn't play dice. So David Bohm was trying to find out what was the rule behind the dice playing. And it turns out that right now, and I know the book and I know David Bohm's work, turns out that all the experiments that have been done in the last 20 years point to the fact that there does not seem to be an implicate order on the underlying quantum mechanics.
Okay, when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Dr. Gleiser on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Dr. Lorianne Levin joins us as we talk about this incredible story of the three-year-old who made contact with the other side. That'll be next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Marcelo, you say in the book and the work, A Tear at the Edge of Creation, that intelligent life is but a precious accident.
That's right.
And, tell me about that accident.
Well, you know, if you look at our planet and what has happened here in the last 3.5 billion years, which is the amount of time that we know life has been present on Earth,
mm-hmm.
you realize that there were so many hurdles for life to go from simple to complicated, and then from complicated to human, that we know the odds are very small that the same things will happen elsewhere. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
When we think of old life, you know, complicated old life, we think of dinosaurs, right? Now, the dinosaurs were on Earth for 150 million years. That's a long, long time, much longer than our 200,000. Now, in 150 million years, the dinosaurs were not smart. They were pretty stupid as far as we know. You know, they didn't build radios or machines of any kind. They were just happy because it turns out that life is not really directed towards intelligence. Life only cares about being well adapted to its environment. That's what the theory of evolution with natural selection says, is that life cares about being well adapted, meaning eating well, being okay in balance with your predators. So the dinosaurs were fine for 150 million years until this giant 6-mile-wide asteroid fell in the Yucatan Peninsula off the coast of Mexico. And when that happened, it changed the whole planet in such a dramatic way that the reptiles, the dinosaurs having cold blood, could not survive the environmental changes, and they were extinct together with about 45% of life on Earth. So it was an accident, a cosmic cataclysm that essentially ended the reign, 150 million years of dinosaurs here on the planet, and changed the history of life forever. So what people think is that, oh, you know, if you have life in another planet, then you're going to have intelligent life, because if life exists, then it's just a matter of time before it becomes intelligent. Well, that's absolutely not true. You can have non-intelligent complex life like dinosaurs, etc., which then tells us that even if you have life, and even if you have multicellular, that is complex life forms in another planet, there's no guarantee whatsoever that it's going to be intelligent. So that's why intelligent life is rare.
That's a good point. All right, let's go back to final calls. We'll go to North Carolina. Jeffrey, thank you for holding, and you are up with us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, George. Hi, Marcelo. This is Jeff from North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
You lead into my question really good. If life is as rare in the universe and our solar system as you say it is, and I agree with you, and if conscious, intelligent life is even more rare, don't we as a human species have a moral obligation, a moral imperative to spread as much life around the lifeless galaxy as we can? Don't we have a moral obligation to terraform Mars, or to bring human civilization to Mars or the moon, or if we have the capability to go to other worlds, if those worlds truly are lifeless, don't we have a moral imperative to bring conscious life to those other worlds? So the real mission and purpose of humanity may not just be to be good stewards of the Earth, but to bring Earth-like life forms, particularly conscious life forms, to other planets. What do you think about that suggestion?
I think that's a wonderful suggestion. So, and in my book, I actually do develop this point in some detail, and I'm with you. I think that first, of course, we take care of our home and make sure that we don't destroy it, because as I said before, it's a very, very special place. But then absolutely, I think life, at least the life we know, likes to spread around, and perhaps we humans are the vectors of this future spread of life across the galaxy. I like to play that perhaps we are the ones that are going to be the ETs. You know, we are the ones that are going to colonize the galaxy and make the galaxy a living thing. So absolutely, I like your suggestion, and I would vouch for it. The only problems that we have with that is that the technological difficulties are gigantic, right? Like terraforming Mars, for example, is an incredibly complex process that we are very, very far from understanding how to do it. We can't even fly to Mars, not because we don't have the technology to get to Mars. We do, but we can't go there because humans can't stay 6 months in space. It takes about 6 months to get there, and the amount of radiation that will be exposed, the astronauts will be exposed to, will be incredibly damaging. So we have so many hurdles to get there that in the short term, the most important moral imperative, to use our expression, is to actually take care of our planet so that indeed eventually one day we're going to have a solid platform to launch ourselves into the rest of the universe.
So I guess you do not believe in what we call intelligent design, a specific creator, right, who sat back and went, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to. And what baffles me, though, Marcelo, is the fact that everything seems to have so much order. It has place. It has direction. It has reason. And I just have to keep coming back to the fact that something gave it its order.
Yeah, you see, we seem to be stuck with the idea that if there is some kind of order, then it has to have a designer for it.
True.
But if you look, and because we are that way, I mean, we are watchmakers, right? Mm-hmm. We make watches, we make clocks, and
we design them as we make them.
And we design them as we make them, and we say, well, look at the world, you know, the world is seems to have some kind of order out there. But it turns out that you can show that the order that the world has really is the consequence of trial and error and adaptation. You know, nature is an amazingly wise thing. Nature loves to save energy. It never spends more energy than it should. So, for example, if you spill water, okay, on the ground, the water is going to automatically collect itself in the lowest possible pond and form a nice circular kind of shaped pond. Now, why is that, right? They said, well, you know, look at that. The water seems to know where it's going and adopts a nice circular shape. It seems like there is a designer behind it, and there really isn't. It's just that water is going to gravitationally be drawn to the lowest possible point it can go to. And once it gets there, because of a property called surface tension, it will adopt the circular shape. So many of the times that we look at the world and we see order and we think there is a design, there are just very simple natural forces at play. And so we have to be a little careful about separating these two things. Now, the argument from intelligent design says that there are some aspects of biological systems, of living things, that are so complex that there is no way they could have started simple and evolved that level of complexity. It's what they called irreducible complexity. And it turns out that if you actually think about it, and if you look at what evolutionary biologists are saying, there's plenty of evidence that, for example, the eye, which is an amazing machine, if you want, evolved in steps, you know, over millions and millions of years, and there is no big mystery about it. So I think the intelligent design people really have a very clear agenda, which is to bring God into some sort of scientific description of the world. And we scientists that are not intelligent designers don't see any need for that.
Interesting. Okay, Tim in Seattle, you're up with us. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, George, I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening to you for 4 years.
Thank you.
And I consider you the most courageous man on Earth, just like I consider Alex Jones the bravest man on Earth. And I'm not quite sure how you guys got to the political mountaintop, but you did. But here's my question. Doctor, mankind considers you the beacon of hope, the scientific community, the scientists, the physicists, the big thinkers. That's the hope of mankind. But I've come to view you, your class of people in the scientific community as the most destructive force, and for this reason. In light of that, most of the scientific community and the intellectuals and the intelligentsia is paid for by the people who rule this world, and in light of Climategate, which just completely destroyed you people's credibility, I ask you these two questions, and then I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. These two questions are, when man reaches the age of the theory of singularity, and I'm sure you know what that is, how are we supposed to, as a species, survive singularity? And secondly, where's all the information? Where are the pictures, close-up pictures of Venus? Why isn't the Hubble telescope taking pictures of Mars? Where's all this information that seems to be being withheld from all of us on what's really going on? You say there's not life. I see life everywhere. I see a galaxy of 100 billion stars, a universe with 100 with a trillion galaxies. Come on, doctor. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. I don't think he's mad at you, Marcelo. I think he's mad at the industry.
It's okay. That's perfectly fine. And I understand his frustration. But there are some good things that I can say that hopefully he's still listening.
Oh, yeah, he is,
and,
of course.
And maybe he'll change his mind just a little bit. First, the easy ones. The questions about the Hubble and the pictures, you can actually see spectacular pictures of everything, of all the planets and galaxies. And if you want, you just have to go to Google and you type Hubble Gallery. And that will give you the gallery of photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope, which is absolutely one of the most stunning and spectacular things you can possibly look at. And you're going to see Mars, and you're going to see Venus. You're going to see all that stuff. So that's one thing that maybe will make you a little happy, that you actually do have access to all of that. This is all public domain, and there is nothing forbidden or hidden about it whatsoever. As the science as being a destructive force, you know, if you look at my blog on National Public Radio, you're going to see that I write similar things. I talk about what is called the shadow light of science and the light side of science. There is a bit of both. You know, you talk about destruction, and I agree with you. I wrote an article recently about the madness of nuclear weapons and where has it taken society and civilization. But on the other hand, you cannot neglect the good of science as well. You know, you have to think about what you have just done, which is you picked up the telephone and you talked to a guy who is in the East Coast at almost 4 a.m, in fact, talking about the universe, you know, and this is also science. And the fact that when we are sick, we take antibiotics, or we use all sorts of marvels that physics and chemistry developed for the pharmaceutical industry to make us better, and the energies and the uses of technology and digital technology. So it's not fair, I would say, to group all of scientists as the bad guys and that we are serving corporations, because that's not quite true. Some of us are actually doing lots of good things. We're educating people. We're bringing good things to society, and we're actually doing it because we love to do it, because we think that science actually has something good to contribute to the world, and the more people know about it, the less people are going to feel threatened by it, as you do feel right now.
Fair enough. Jim in Pennsylvania, first-time caller. Jim, you're up. Go ahead, Jim.
Pleasure to talk to you, George. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks.
The question I have for your guest is, well, I guess I could say the reason I'm calling tonight is I have a 14-year-old daughter at home who is way ahead of her time in thought and thinking, a lot of questions about God, a lot of questions she's asking that I really don't have answers for to give to her. And your show has helped me in a lot of ways give her some answers to some of the questions she had. But the specific question I have for your guest is, I would like to know his opinion on time itself. I'm wondering if he could just think of the possibility that time could be a perception that we have rather than an actuality or an absolute, in the fact that maybe we are just a continuous string of energy and mass that changes from form to form, just like an automobile. Eventually it's built up and then eventually it will just rust away, rather than being an absolute. If you can understand where I'm coming from, that time is a physical perception that we see with our eyes rather than being an actuality.
That's a very deep and complicated question. Let me start by saying I also have a 14-year-old daughter, and they do take us for a loop. There is no question about it with many of these tough questions, which is a wonderful thing, you know, because basically they're trying to make sense of who they are and the kind of world they live in, and that's what growing up is about. So the issue of time, you know, time is a very complicated one. St. Augustine, you know, this famous, very important Catholic theologian from the 4th century, he would say that if you ask me if you don't ask me what time is, I know what it is. But if you ask me to explain what time is, I do not know, right? So it is not easy to define what time is. And you do have a point there, which is to say that time is a perception. So the way we think about time from a physics, because you can think of time, you know, in a physics perspective, you can think of time in a psychological perspective, and they are complementary, but they are not the same thing. So in physics, what we do is we use time to give a measurement of transformation. So whenever there is a system that changes, time is a parameter that we use to describe how that change is happening. So if things do not change, you know, if you have a glass of water sitting at a table and nobody touches it, you really don't need time to describe that because nothing is changing there. So time is a measure of change, if you want, right? And so that's one thing. Now, from a psychological perspective, you're right that we perceive change in the world, we perceive us changing, and so we want to quantify that somehow, and we created this entity, which we call time, in order to quantify the changes that we see in ourselves and in the world around us. So I think that the question, does time exist, does time or does not exist, I prefer to think of time as something that we invented, we humans invented, in order to describe how the world around us is changing.
Absolutely. Okay. And tell me about your blog on NPR.
So, yeah, so this is something that started in December. It's a group of four scientists, two physicists, and two biologists, all pretty well-known people. It's called 13.7, and 13.7 is the age of the universe, so it's 13.7 billion years, so that's the blog's name. And it's really a blog about science, culture, and science and religion. There's a lot of interface between science and religion, and we have developed a wonderful group of followers. There are some 50,000 hits a week now, so it really picked up. So National Public Radio is very happy with it, and we're always welcoming, obviously, more people because we want to spread the notion that science is part of culture, that science is not the owner of truth, but it's part of a dialogue, and that even though we do develop machines and laws of nature, we're still people with a heart and people that think about the world and the human condition in very humanistic terms.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Marcelo, so much. We'll get you back on again. I'd like you to be a regular on the program.
That would be awesome. I'm very happy that we did this.
All right, you take care of yourself. And when I come back in just a moment, we shall talk about that little three-year-old boy who died for several hours, came back, but said that his great-grandmother was the one who told him to come back. That's next.